Sister B again, which made Cannon blurt that I was the one person at school no one, not a teacher or student, a parent, a maintenance worker, or even an aunt, could ever say anything bad about.
"And your nice isn't even irritating," said Cannon.
"Remember how in biology," said Kip, smirking, "B didn't even tell Mr. Jetty that Chad Berman had just thrown up his entire lunch all over the back of her blouse? She just sat there heroically answering his question about osmosis and then excused herself.
And the field trip to D.C. when Mr. Miller had to go home to his pregnant wife, and rather than summon another teacher from campus to chaperone, Ms. Gill just asked B." They cackled with laughter.
"It wasn't that big a deal," I said.
During this conversation, Whitley remained tellingly silent, a smug expression on her face as she stared at the floor, as if she begged to differ, as if she wanted to laugh.
"When is it coming?" I wondered with a shiver. "The conversation about Jim?"
The absent leader. The sixth member. The killed one. Weren't they dying to talk about him? Jim, whose shadow stretched behind him, long and dark, as captivating dead as he was when he was alive. Jim the poet. Jim the prince. Of course they were thinking about him. How could they not? Yet it seemed he was the locked shed on the forsaken property everyone was too scared to approach, much less peer inside all the filthy windows. Not long after, I passed out. When I woke up, peeling my cheek from the couch cushions, Whitley and Cannon were asleep under a blanket in front of the fireplace. Kip was snoring on the love seat. Only Martha was awake. She appeared to have sobered up and was sitting across the room in a club chair, reading with her chin in her hand.
"Hey," I croaked, rubbing my eyes. "What time is it?"
4:15. It was still dark out, and still raining. "Can't sleep," Martha said with a wan smile. "It's that old man. I feel like he's still out there." Her remark made me glance out the windows, shivering. Whitley had turned on every light, and I could see the giant fallen branch, the gardens and pool, the stone path leading down to the dock.
"I'm sure it's fine," I whispered.
We went on talking, though eventually the silences between our words stretched out farther and farther, like the distance between a final chain of tiny islands before the open sea. Martha and I had never been close, though by rights we should have been. As the only scholarship kids at Darrow, we were two rescue mutts of humble bloodlines and skittish temperaments thrown into a kennel of world-class purebreds. She'd attended Darrow on a physics scholarship established by a genius alumnus who'd worked on the God particle. She'd been the first winner in 28 years. Valedictorian of our class, she went to MIT on a full ride for mathematical engineering. She'd been raised in South Philadelphia by a single dad, and her family was even poorer than mine. I never met her dad, though Cannon once said he owned a gas station and went by the nickname Mickey Peanuts. Jim told me Martha had had a considerably older sister who died of a drug overdose, and that death was the reason Martha's mother left. But Martha never mentioned a sister, and any talk of her mom was in connection with a single trip to Alaska she'd taken when she was 10. I'd spent hours in her company, yet I couldn't tell you who or what Martha ever loved beyond this weird underground fantasy novel called The Bend. The book was why she wallpapered her dorm room with mysterious posters of steam trains and scoured Reddit forums for other mega fans, known as benders. She even dressed up, with a surprising lack of embarrassment, once in a top hat and spectacles or a gray barrister's wig, to celebrate the apparent birthdays of the characters. She always kept a copy of the book at the bottom of her backpack, pulling out the doorstop of 1,000 torn-up pages, crudely Xeroxed, bound with frayed twine, at the start of class, reading, it seemed, to avoid talking to anyone. At heart, she was Jim's friend. They'd met when they were kids at some invitation-only camp for the gifted, housed in a 19th-century mansion in upstate New York called Da Vinci's Daughters and Sons. Jim was there because he'd composed an entire musical about Napoleon, which had been staged at his Manhattan private school and gotten him profiled in New York Magazine. Martha was there because she'd built a working airplane engine in her garage. It was Jim who urged Martha to apply to Darrow, Jim who sought to have her around. Over the years, she'd become an integral part of our group, giving every situation its deadpan punctuation or making some awkward reference to a chapter in The Bend that no one understood. And yet I always suspected Jim had been her only true champion, that Cannon, Wit, and Kip accepted her the way one accepts a lifelong inconvenience, like asthma or a spouse's beloved cat. He never stopped insisting she was amazing, that one day when we were 60 we'd look back and think with disbelief, I was friends with Martha Ziegler.
Which will be like saying you were friends with Steve Hawking. That's how big she's going to be.
The two of them had a shabby shorthand, laughing at things only they found funny, arms slung around each other's necks like old cardigans. While it didn't make me jealous per se, it could lead me to notice something Martha did. Heavy glance, weird remark, that would set off alarm bells, and I'd entertain my long-standing suspicion that she was harboring a burning secret. She was in love with Jim. It was why she'd never liked me. I could only assume she'd been heartbroken by his death. In the aftermath, the 10 or so days before summer break, she was glum and taciturn, scuttling out of final chapel ahead of the entire school like some startled attic bat. She was agitated. Dimly, I recalled how she'd left school suddenly the day before I did, vanishing without saying goodbye. Whitley, ever attentive to the embarrassing things people wish to hide, couldn't stop saying, "Something's up with Martha." Now here she was, staring at me with that stark telephoto stare I'd always found nerve-wracking. Whatever she had felt about Jim's death, whatever had been uprooted, was hidden now, like a pod of blue whales thundering through the depths of an ocean with a still surface. I realized that she'd just asked me a question.
"What?"
"I was wondering if you still made those dream soundtracks." She was referring to my hobby of creating albums for movies I made up. It was just something I did. I didn't know why. As a child, I'd always been painfully shy, so terrified of speaking in class, my teachers often thought I had a stutter or a hearing problem. I began crafting pocket-sized books with lyrics and hand-drawn art for movies I wished existed, like the soundtrack to a hit teen vampire movie called Blood Academy. Or Dove Nova, the biopic of a Swedish teen pop star who vanished into thin air, her disappearance forever unsolved. There was no point to these albums. I couldn't even explain why I made them, except that I liked to imagine they were artifacts of some other world that existed beyond the one we could see. A world where I wasn't timid, and unsaid words didn't collect in my mouth like marbles, and I was brave. They were my what-ifs, my glass menagerie, as Jim said. One night, freshman year, during a snowstorm, the whole school was in the auditorium for holiday dance when the power went out. I had accidentally ripped the back of my dress, so I left Jim to run back to my dorm to change. To my surprise, I encountered Martha in the dark of the common room, reading Pride and Prejudice with a flashlight, so absorbed she hadn't realized one of the windows was wide open and snow was collecting in the corner 3 inches thick. We ended up hanging out for 2 hours, just the two of us. It was the only time we ever did. For some reason, probably in the hopes of making things less uncomfortable between us, I'd shown Martha my collection of dream albums. Ever since then, when we were alone, she tended to ask about them, like they were some one-size-fits-all subject she could rely on to get me to talk. It could be a little unnerving.
"No," I said, feigning a yawn. "Not really. I think I'll go find a bed upstairs.
She nodded, her face solemn.
Good night, Beatrice.
I slipped out, Martha returning to her book, and trudged upstairs, finding my favorite guest room at the end of the hall. I pulled back the comforter and slung myself into bed. Any other night I would have been kept awake by the memories inside that room. I was curled up under the heavy covers, same as always. The only thing missing was Jim snuggled beside me, composing lyrics by the light of his cell phone. I set my alarm for 6 and closed my eyes. I'd sneak out before any of them were awake. And that, for better or worse, would close my final chapter on Wincroft.
Chapter 4. When I awoke, it was light out. I was freezing and covered in sweat.
No, not sweat, I realized after a moment, blinking. It was rain. I was soaked because I was sitting in the back seat of the Jaguar convertible, the top still down. It had been parked, seemingly by someone very drunk, in a flower bed in the front yard of Wincroft. It was still pouring rain. Kip and Martha were beside me, wearing confused expressions.
"What are you doing?"
Kip asked me. He was soaking wet, his eyes bloodshot. A raindrop dangled off the end of his nose.
"Where are you taking us?"
I had no clue what he was talking about. I scrambled out of the car, raced across the driveway to the mansion, and threw open the front door. I nearly collided with Whitley. She was frozen in the foyer, wearing the same outfit she'd had on last night. She surveyed me with a look so stunned, I understood immediately that something terrible had happened.
"What? What is it?"
She only stepped past me, staring out the door, speechless. I hurried past her into the kitchen. Shivering, I took inventory of my body. I felt fine. My head was clear. Yet somehow I'd overslept. I wasn't going to make it to the Crow by opening. My parents would be scrambling to keep up with the morning crowd, then lunch, and my dad would be so strapped he'd forget to tell people about the specials, and my mom would use this as an excuse to say they didn't need specials anymore, they were too expensive, which was sometimes enough of a spark to make them start arguing, which they rarely did. Cannon was standing at the kitchen island typing on his open laptop.
"See? Look!"
he shouted over his shoulder, seemingly believing I was Whitley.
"New York Times! It's the exact same thing!"
I stepped beside him. He was amped, like he'd had about 6 cups of coffee.
"What is it?"
"What is it?" he mocked, turning to me. He grabbed my head, directing it at the screen. "Senate pushes for new immigration initiative," I read.
"The date!" he snapped.
"Friday, August 30th. So?"
"So? So? It's yesterday!"
Scowling, he was tapping the keyboard, loading CNN.
"CNN, The Post, Time, all of them say the same thing."
He shoved his iPhone into my hands. I blinked stupidly down at the date overlaying a photo of what had to be his fencing champion girlfriend. He was right. August 30. 5:34 p.m. There had to be an error with the international dateline. Terrorists had hacked the network. As if reading my mind, he held up his wristwatch, the hour and minute hands set to 5:35. The date turned to 30.
"How could hackers get into my Tag Heuer?"
I could only stare. At that moment, his phone rang. Someone named Alexandra. He snatched the phone.
"Alex, hold on. Now, wait a... Tell me what day and time it is. The date and time. I'll explain in a sec. Would you tell me the goddamn date? I'm not asking you to recite the Declaration of... Would you please just shut up and tell me..."
Whatever Alex's confused response was, Cannon furiously hurled the phone at the sliding glass doors. He collapsed on the couch, staring wild-eyed at the floor. I hurried to my purse and dug out my phone, which was actually pretty strange because the last time I'd seen it, it had been upstairs. My phone read the same thing, August 30. With a shiver of panic, I dialed my mom. Hi, Bumble. Mom? Mom? Where are you? On our way to the Dreamland to see His Girl Friday. What's the matter?
You didn't see the movie yesterday?
Yesterday? Mom, what day is it?
What? Why are you shouting? What's the date?
It's Friday, August 30th.
Are you positive? I'm looking at the dashboard right now.
It's the 30th, I heard my dad chime in.
Mom, I called you last night, remember?
Last night? What?
Last night, I called and said I was spending the night at Wincroft, and you asked me to be in for opening because Sleepy Sam was getting a tooth pulled.
Sam is out tomorrow?
He called you?
Sam is out tomorrow, she told my dad.
He called B after we've made sure he has our number about 19 times.
B, what's going on up there? Is it awful? Why don't we come get you?
I hung up, blood rushing in my ears. My mom called back, but I was too shaken to answer. I sat on the couch, trying to calm down.
This had to be some kind of lucid dream. I willed myself to wake up. Wake up!
After a moment, I realized Kip and Martha had drifted inside. They were standing stiffly with stricken expressions, like they'd just woken up from sleepwalking. Whitley had stepped back into the kitchen, her every gesture slow, as if pretending to walk on the moon.
Y'all?
Whispered Kip, his voice scarcely audible.
Was there an earthquake? Or some end-of-days world event we're just finding out about?
That was when the doorbell rang. I didn't wait for the others. I jumped off the couch, sprinting past Kip and Martha, and yanked open the front door.
Perhaps this time I'll be invited in for tea, said the old man.
Chapter 5.
The first thing you must do is stay calm, said the keeper. Panic will get you nowhere.
He was making tea. He had asked for tea when he'd strolled inside, and as we were all too alarmed to react to what he was saying, he had, incredibly, started making it for himself. He filled the kettle, turned on the gas stove, and grabbed a mug from the cabinet, as if he had visited this house many times before.
If it's any reassurance, remember one thing, he continued, his fingers nimbly straightening his dark blue silk tie.
It caught the overhead light, and I saw it had a discernible pattern of stags identical to the stag presiding over the entrance to Darrow.
Others have gone through the Neverworld before you. Many more will after. Hundreds of millions of others will expire never having had the opportunity that each of you has. So you must look at this as a gift. A chance to change history. For your choice of who will live will affect billions of moments barreling into the future for infinity. In other words, there is a precedent, and you aren't alone. You must rely on each other. Each of you is a key, the others your locks. This isn't a nightmare, and it isn't a dream. It's a crack you will continue to fall through until you vote. The sooner you accept where you are, the sooner you will all escape.
The old man here, again, wearing the same dark suit, speaking in the same grand voice, was so incongruous and strange, none of us could really pay attention to anything he was saying. Whitley and Kip were standing by the kitchen island, staring open-mouthed at him as if he were a poltergeist. Martha was on the couch, stone-faced, her feet planted like she felt faint. I was doing my best to follow what he said, in case there was some clue that might reveal who he actually was. Yet all the while my mind was screaming, "It's a prank, it's a prank." It had to be. Somebody. International terrorists, hackers from Anonymous, or some other group, was playing a cruelly ingenious trick. I noticed Cannon had disappeared upstairs. Now he reappeared, hauling his duffel.
"I'm out," he announced.
"What?" asked Whitley, alarmed. "Where are you going?"
"Airport."
"But it's yesterday," said Kip.
"No, it's not. Of course it's not. Yeah, we can't explain it, but there is an explanation. I'm sure the physics department at Harvard is working on this as we speak."
"I'm afraid the physics department at Harvard is ignorant of your plight," interjected the keeper, wringing out the teabag on a spoon. "They've got their hands quite full trying to solve quantum gravity. Specifically, the vacuum catastrophe."
Cannon surveyed him coldly.
"I'm going home."
"To do what?" asked Kip. "Complain? Ma? Today's kinda yesterday."
Cannon shrugged. "I'll be damned if I'm staying here with him." He left. We listened to the front door slam. Then, suddenly, Whitley was scrambling after him. And Kipling. Martha, too. They were all moving, running away as if they'd just learned the old man was wearing explosives. They grabbed car keys, handbags, sweatshirts, phones. I didn't want to be left alone with him, so I grabbed my bag and ran out into the downpour, too. They were sprinting to their cars, engines roaring the life, windshield wipers flying. By the time I'd started the Dodge truck and reversed, all four cars were gone. The keeper had walked out onto the front steps. He took a sip of his tea. The reality of the situation, that we were just leaving him there in the house, a complete stranger, was too wild to fathom.
"Don't worry,"
he shouted cheerfully at me over the rain.
"I promise not to steal the silver."
I floored the gas. As I roared down the driveway, I had the acute feeling of being chased. Yet, rounding another bend, I saw no one behind me. When I took a final glance back at Wincroft, the red brick mansion sinking behind the hill, even the keeper appeared to be gone. It began to get dark. The rain was relentless, the sky black and blue. As soon as I'd gone a few miles, peering in at every driver to make sure they were alive and not ghosts, aliens, or zombies, most doing double takes, wondering what my problem was, I began to relax. All the drivers looked human, alive, and ordinary, chewing gum, fiddling with the radio, utterly at ease with what day it was, what time it was. Everything was normal. I called my mom again.
"B? Where are you?"
"In the movie. What's going on? You scared us the way you sounded before." I drove straight to the Dreamland in Westerly. My parents were waiting outside, ashen. I parked in the fire lane, leaving the engine running. I wrenched the door and ran, throwing my arms around them. They were real. I wasn't dreaming. It was going to be all right. My mom was distraught.
"You're never speaking to any of those people again."
"Victoria," admonished my dad.
"What? Look at her. She's completely undone. We're not going through this again. No, those kids are rotten, spoiled. They'll live their entire lives without ever turning around to see the mess they've made. Mommy and Daddy always running after them with a maid and a checkbook."
"They're just kids."
"Just kids left our daughter barely able to eat or sleep for 2 months, if you remember."
"That was shock,"
and grief.
I was crying, but of course they couldn't understand the real reason, that it was relief. The day that had already happened, whatever it was, hadn't been real. This was real. I managed to calm my parents down, and we went to dinner at the Shakedown. We talked with Artie, who gave us free apple pie. We strolled along the boardwalk and talked about the umpteenth offer from developers who told my daddy had to sell the Captain's Crow so they could build condos. Though my parents were alarmed, not just by my abrupt appearance, but by the uncharacteristic gusto with which I was approaching spending an evening with them, something I had done with relative apathy all summer. They said nothing. They pretended they believed my excuse for abruptly leaving Wincroft. I had to get out of there. We've all outgrown each other, you know? They also humored my manic need to keep the night going, to walk a little farther down the boardwalk, to stare in at every sailboat painting and every window of every art gallery, to walk out to the old swings on the beach where someone had spray-painted on the wall, "Life is but a dream," thereby postponing the inevitability of driving home and going to bed. I was afraid to sleep, because the glaring fact that I had already lived this day nagged like a bad pop song that wouldn't leave my head. We got home just after midnight. Dad drove the Dodge Ram as I said I was too tired, though the real reason was I was scared to be alone in the car. We filed into the house, my dad yawning. My mom loaded the dishwasher. "Will you stay with me until I fall asleep?" I asked her. "Of course." She smiled, though I could tell the question worried her. The last time I'd asked her to do that, it was just after Jim died. She sat on my bed as we talked about changing the menu at the Crow, the community vote to tear down a drawbridge. I knew she wanted to ask me about them, my old friends, what had happened tonight, but thought better of it. At one point, she stood up to inspect the white daisy wallpaper of my room. "I can't believe it. Your dad said he fixed this." She scratched at a seam in the corner, tugging the edge. A large chunk immediately peeled from the wall. "Are you kidding me? There's actually mold here." "It's a sign you and Dad should sell the Crow and retire to Florida." She crossed her arms. "Do I look like someone who wears a visor?" I began to feel heavy sleep falling over me. She said something about my dad's bad back, how it was hurting him more than he let on. I held her hand as I passed out. My mom's hand was real. What had come before was not. So a day had decided to repeat itself. Is it really that big a deal? What lies the mind will tell to keep you safe? The mind does its best to lessen the impact of any catastrophe. It really tries its best. But then the distance between reality and woven fantasy becomes too great for even the mind to bear. All those words of calm and relief, the hope that everything will be all right in the end, can't help stretching and tearing and fading to nothing. Then you wake up screaming. I woke up in the downpour in the back seat of the Jaguar, Martha and Kipling beside me again. When I sprinted away from them into the house, I was shaking so badly I had to sit on the couch, feet apart, hands on my knees, trying not to hyperventilate. I was here again. I was back at Wincroft. At least I was alive. But was this life? Gandalf was running in circles around the living room, barking.
"No, no, no!"
shouted Cannon. He was at the kitchen island typing on his laptop again, though, undoubtedly after seeing that the date was the same, he slammed it closed and threw it across the room. I realized, dazedly, glancing up, that Whitley was outside, in the throes of one of her rages. Completely soaked, she was pulling the white umbrellas out of the patio tables and launching them over the railing. Her temper had been legendary at Darrow. "Psychotic fits.
the cattier girls used to hiss. I'd always found it enviable that Whitley could be so beautiful and smart and on top of that so unconcerned about causing a scene or curbing her biblical emotions. It seemed unfairly glamorous, like she was the untamable heroine of a Victorian novel. Even the oft-gossiped-about phrase around school, Lansing's temper, sounded gorgeously bygone, like the name of an exotic illness with no cure. To be so wild, it was how I longed to be. Wit surged into battle. I froze. Whitley threw her head back and screamed. I was mute. Her rages were Olympian, five-star, multi-platinum. They came from some boiling place inside her not even she could explain. Face flushed, eyes flashing, she'd demolish her dorm room, rip pages from every textbook, punch walls, overturn tables, tell off a teacher with zero care for tact, mercy, or an aftermath. It always seemed to me in those moments that Whitley was witnessing some alternative world invisible to the rest of us. Something ugly and so vast it couldn't be fit into the English language. Her rages got her sent to the infirmary. They would have gotten her kicked out if it weren't for her mom, the Linda, CEO of the pharmaceutical group Lansing Drugs, flying in from St. Louis in her fat mink to smooth everything over, which meant funding another wing for the library. It was the reason Whitley got special permission to leave school to go see a psychologist up in Newport. Whenever a fit happened, I'd always run to her side and hold on to her, like some astronaut trying to make sure my colleague didn't float out into space. Now, as I watched her seize a deck chair and throw it over the railing screaming, I could only observe her blankly, unable to move. I couldn't help her. I couldn't help myself. Kipling and Martha had wandered in and were looking around the kitchen like people visiting their property after a tornado.
"We have to call someone,"
Kipling said, his voice shaking.
"The FBI, the CIA?"
"And say what?" asked Martha, turning to him. "Time has become a broken record."
"There have got to be others going through this. It's a national emergency."
"I'm sure Anderson Cooper's all over it," muttered Cannon. He was on the floor, hands linked around his neck like he was in a bomb shelter.
"Today, a new kind of breaking news. Yesterday is today. Again, more on this story as it never develops. Tweet us your experiences with hashtag Groundhog Day is real."
Kipling grabbed the remote and turned on the TV, flipping through channels, everyone yelping something normal.
"Coming up, we'll show you how to make a 3-minute omelet. Keeps whites white and colors brand new."
The doorbell rang. No one moved. Within seconds, the keeper had strolled inside, a sympathetic, even grandfatherly look on his face. There was something insidious about him now. Same suit, same tie. I felt like I was going to be sick.
"This will be the worst of it," he said. "It's the second wake that feels the most catastrophic."
"Tell us what to do," said Martha.
"I did.
Take the vote." Take the vote. As if it were just a matter of making a left turn rather than a right. Whitley must have spotted the old man from outside, because suddenly she heaved the sliding door open and stood in the doorway, panting and scowling at him, gusts of rain blasting around her like a storm scene in an old movie. Before anyone could stop her, she was sprinting inside. She grabbed a Chinese vase off a table and slung it at the old man's head. He crumpled to the floor. Cannon ran to Whitley, but she brutally elbowed him off, grabbing the keeper by his necktie and forcing him into a chair. Then she was barreling into the kitchen, pulling open drawers, tossing pots, ladles, cooking spoons to the floor.
"The cycle of violence is actually a pointless denial of reality," said the keeper, holding his head.
Whitley was back in front of him with cooking twine, brutally tying up his wrists, brandishing a 14-inch carving knife inches from his jaw as she sliced the string. Crouching, teeth gritted, she moved to his ankles.
The keeper didn't protest, only watching her, bemused, like a father when his 4-year-old decides to bury him alive at the beach. She dragged a stool over and sat in front of him, brushing her hair out of her eyes.
Start talking.
About what? Asked the keeper. She smacked him hard across the cheek.
Whitley, reproached Cannon. Tell us who did this and how we get out of here.
The keeper closed his eyes.
I've already told you, the vote.
As for who?
There is an infinite number of possibilities. The universe, God, the absolute, the supreme being, he who actually is, Adonai, Ahura Mazda.
She slapped him again.
Wit, whispered Kipling.
You think it's wise to go all Tarantino on this poor man?
He's not poor. He's toying with us.
She slapped him again. The keeper remained unperturbed, blood trickling from his nose. I started to cry. And yet I made no attempt to stop her. None of us did. We stood there, frozen, all doubtlessly wondering, terrible as it was to admit, if hurting the keeper might reveal something, something that would end this. He'd confess it was an elaborate game. The curtain would fall, scenery crashing. We'd laugh. How hilarious! You really had me going there. I also couldn't help hoping that, as with so many nightmares I'd had as a child, if things became sufficiently strange, the dream would at last puncture and I'd wake up.
Whitley hit him again. The final 3 minutes of every wake, you will each vote for the single person among you who will survive.
Why only one? Asked Martha sharply, stepping beside Whitley.
I can't explain the whys and hows of the Neverworld. They were determined by you.
But if time has stopped, asked Cannon, why can we return to our normal lives?
Only for 11.2 hours. 672 minutes. The length of your wake.
For Cannon and Whitley, it's 675. At the end of that time, you will all wake up in the Neverworld again, as surely as Cinderella's stagecoach turns back into a pumpkin. Even though your accident produced a snag in the space-time fabric, a crinkle in the cloth, the present world hasn't disappeared. It remains alive all around you, a bullet left in the gun chamber.
What is the significance of our arrival time in the wake?
Asked Martha.
The beginning and end of a wake are based on an infinite number of factors, including violent impact, strength of connection, and random chance.
Whitley, seemingly unable to hear another word, flung down the knife. She seized her phone off the kitchen island and had a curt, unintelligible conversation before hanging up, shoving her feet into her Converse sneakers.
What are you doing now? Asked Cannon. Driving to T.F. Green.
It was the airport for private jets outside Providence.
I booked the jet to Hawaii. We're leaving in an hour. Let's go.
Won't change a thing, I'm afraid, said the keeper.
She glared at him.
We will be in a plane 36,000 feet over the Pacific Ocean at the end of the, what did you call it, the wake? What's going to happen? We just vanish out of our seats like some Willy Wonka magic trick?
You'll see, said the keeper.
Everyone went with Whitley except me. I couldn't. I was too devastated, too scared to move so far away from my parents, to be trapped in a box in the sky with them.
Them.
They were them to me too now. I wasn't one of them, not anymore. If this situation had made anything clear, it was that. That the very people I'd once loved and trusted most in the world had become total strangers. What had I done to deserve this? To end up in hell with them? I couldn't think about it. No, I couldn't let my mind move ahead. It had to stay on a tight leash tied to this moment. It was all I could handle. I watched them pile with varying degrees of conviction into Cannon's jeep. It was obvious that they suspected Whitley's plan. An impetuous flight westward to a tropical island was futile. Yet they went ahead. For a show of solidarity, some last vain hope that it might actually work, that the Linda's Gulfstream V tearing through the pink cotton candy clouds with its beige calfskin seats and trays of fanned-out mango slices would be the loophole, the wormhole, the get-out-of-jail-free card to puncture this nightmare. I stumbled down the steps, barely aware of the rain drenching me as I climbed into the truck. As I backed out, I saw that the keeper had managed to free himself from Whitley's knots. Once again, he was at the entrance, his face bloody and red, Gandalf at his side, as if the dog had always belonged to him. This time the old man didn't utter a word. He didn't have to. His smile at me as I drove past him said it all. See you later. Chapter 6. You can't stay awake. We tried that. No matter how many cups of coffee or how many cans of Red Bull or Monster energy drinks you down, no matter how many caffeine pills or how much ginseng you take, your body gets pulled into the heaviest hollow of sleep you've ever felt in your life. The next thing you know, you're right back where you started. Back at the wake. You can't kill yourself either. Kip tried that. He hanged himself with one of ESS Burt's belts in an upstairs bedroom. I didn't see him. Martha told me. The next wake, as usual, he was right beside me in the back seat of the Jaguar, a healthy color. No black and blue marks around his neck. No swollen face. Like nothing had happened.
We're immortal, said Cannon. We should take over the White House.
In 11.2 hours, said Martha. That's not enough time to drive to Chicago, much less rule the free world. Tell your parents, call the police, have the keeper arrested. Call a shrink. Check into the psych ward of Butler Hospital and ask the attending physician to make tomorrow arrive, please. Confess to a priest. Tell a bus driver, a cab driver, the tired waitress at the 24-hour diner who's seen it all, the bent-over elderly woman in the frozen food section of Price Right buying a shocking number of pepperoni hot pockets, the man in the leather jacket browsing engagement rings at Kmart. Read the 252 books in the science section of the Warwick Public Library and a zillion textbooks on Google Books trying to determine if ever in the history of the world some sage like Copernicus, Aristotle, Darwin, or Hawking has ever written or even hinted about such a thing as errors in time, cosmic waiting rooms, lethal lotteries in limbo, human terrariums in hell.
What's the subject you're searching for again?
The librarian asked me.
It's called a never world.
She typed on the keyboard, shaking her head.
Nothing comes up in the Library of Congress.
We tried every one of these things in the beginning. Every time we woke up in the exact same place, exact same time. We were songs on repeat, flies in a mason jar, echoing screams in a canyon that could not fade. The ongoing experience of recurring goes against the very heart of being human, and it is, I will tell you this without flinching, unbearable. The mind rages trying to disprove it. When it can't, the brain breaks down with shocking ease. The psyche is fragile. It is a child's sandcastle in an incoming tide. Never before had I understood how little control we had over our world, or really anything except our own actions. And now my little life didn't even belong to me. We were helpless passengers strapped inside a spaceship circling Mars. The sun, the sky, the stars. How long did I stare at them, lying on the deck chair by the pool in the pouring rain, wishing I could just be them,
a collection of gas and fire.
I'd even take a beetle, a blade of grass, anything, so long as it was outside the Neverworld.
Take the vote, urged the Keeper. Just take the vote.
We took the vote.
Of course we did.
We voted for the first time early in our arrival in the Neverworld. Twilight Zone, Purgatory, Doomed Fate, Survivor, Homeroom, Freaky Friday bullshit. We called it all kinds of names, as if insulting the unknown forces keeping us here would make them change their minds. We assembled in Wincroft's library like colorful characters in the final pages of a murder mystery waiting for the genius detective to unmask the killer. We sat in club chairs. Whitley served champagne. We wrote the name of our chosen survivor on a scrap piece of paper, the Keeper collecting them.
There is no consensus, he announced.
The second time we voted, we each gave a speech beforehand in an attempt to persuade the others why we deserved life and not the others. We were defense attorneys in a courtroom speaking to a jury of the prosecutors, a circular setup of justice that would never work. The speeches ranged from altruistic, Cannon, to woodenly scientific, Martha, to childish and tone-deaf, Whitley, revealing a charitable streak she'd never had before, announcing she'd supply the entire continent of Africa with clean water. Kipling, when he stood up to speak, fell over, he was so drunk.
"You should vote for me because you shouldn't vote for me," he said. "I'm a mediocre, fucked-up shithead."
I spoke last. All I said was that I was an ordinary girl destined for an ordinary life, but they could vote for me because I'd make it my aim to do small acts of kindness every day. As I said it, I was acutely aware that I sounded as disingenuous and desperate as they all did. Even worse, none of them were listening. They watched me, sure, but their attention was buried under the weight of their fates, fastidiously, hungrily inspecting it like Gollum inspecting the ring, wondering if the Neverworld was real. I couldn't blame them. I was a blubbering mess, too. Rarely had I passed the 11.2 hours without bawling as I drove to Westerly to see my parents at the Dreamland, usually just observing them without their knowledge, because to actually spend time with them made me sob uncontrollably the next wake. I'd tried explaining to them what was happening. "I've been in a car accident, and I might die, and this limbo is called the Neverworld Wake, according to this weird old man who won't leave us alone." They always listened. Yet I could see that the only real feeling they had was devastation, believing that Jim's death had messed me up even more than they'd realized, and I needed 24-hour psychiatric care. So I'd gotten in the habit of sitting in the theater, unseen, a few rows behind them, beside this massively fat guy in a Brooklyn Book Drop t-shirt. I always smiled at him, thinking, "Do you realize how lucky you are? You have a tomorrow." I ate popcorn, watched His Girl Friday, and snuck out before the lights came on. The result of that vote was no different.
"There is no consensus," said the Keeper.
We all voted for ourselves. I couldn't foresee a time when we wouldn't. It was all we had to keep us going. The possibility, however remote, of getting out of here, of getting back to life. And all the while, the Keeper watched us. He was still there, appearing when least expected. Sometimes he came inside and made tea. Sometimes he worked on the Wincroft grounds as a gardener, wearing a black hooded slicker. In spite of the rain, which would, during some wakes, turn impossibly to snow, temperature dropping, swirls of snowflakes spinning like miniature tornadoes through the air, the Keeper trimmed vines, rose bushes, ivy, and privet, the wisteria and lilac knotting the trellis. He swept the stone paths and hoed flower beds. He stood atop a green ladder and cleared dead leaves from the gutters, wiped the glass panes clean on lanterns and lamps. He removed lichen from the wings of the crow gargoyles, silently cawing. Other times he could be spotted from a distance, a faceless, silhouetted trespasser hurrying across the lawn and into the woods, as if taking a shortcut through Wincroft's on his way somewhere else. Somewhere unknown. I don't know how long we'd been in the Neverworld when we had the fight. Time was vague here. It miraged and optical illusioned the more you tried to look back on it, or fit it into a traditional monthly calendar. On close inspection, the hours were real. But if we tried to add them up into some larger understanding of the passage of time, how long we'd been here, they evaporated and grew unclear. The passing of 4 weeks felt the same as 400. The more weeks that passed, the more terrified I became. I could feel the others growing listless and distant, as if disinterested in ever actually leaving.
"I vote for Kanye," shouted Cannon, raising his glass. "Kanye is my choice for who lives."
"There is no consensus," announced the keeper.
Whitley began to drink all day. So did Cannon and Kipling. Then all three started helping themselves to the pills ESS Burke kept in his master suite, hundreds of orange bottles of uppers and downers lining the medicine cabinets like candy in a sweet shop. It wasn't uncommon for them all to be either manically hyper or unresponsive and lethargic. Kipling paced outside, having conversations with the rain, wearing nothing but that pink wig and a green silk peacock-patterned bathrobe belonging to one of Bert's girlfriends. Once, while gathering everyone for the vote, I couldn't find him. Searching the mansion, I finally spotted him floating in the pool on a swan raft in the torrential rain.
"Kipling!"
I grabbed the leaf net and used it to haul him to the side. He could barely open his eyes.
"Hello? You there, God? It's me, Judy."
"Kipling, can you hear me?"
"I'd like to order room service, please. I'd like the spaghetti bolognese."
He rolled off the raft into the pool, sinking. I pulled off my shoes and raincoat and dove in after him, finding him drifting motionless along the bottom. Madly, I kicked him back to the surface.
"Kipling, can you hear me?"
"It's the final countdown,"
he sang, his eyes slits. I was the lone nurse working in a madhouse. While Martha had remained sane, she had also decided to remove herself, washing her hands of the situation, it seemed, ducking out without word at the beginning of every week. She spent the day outside. A few times at dusk, I caught sight of her wandering the woods, fringing the far lawns, hauling her black bag, studying the treetops with a pair of binoculars like some professional bird watcher or an environmentalist recording evidence of acid rain. She'd fumble in her bag, which looked so heavy I wondered if inside was a copy of the same underground book, The Bend, she'd lugged around Darrow. Instead, she'd remove a thin black notebook and scribble in it for a minute before trudging on. Once I ran after her.
"Martha!"
She kept walking, pretending she hadn't heard me.
"Martha, wait!"
She stopped and turned. I could see she didn't want to be bothered. Certainly not by me.
"I'm worried about them," I said.
She nodded. "So?" "So?" I could only stare at her, rain coursing down my head and arms. Hadn't she witnessed what was going on? Didn't she care?
"They're going crazy. They're not taking it seriously anymore. I don't know what to do."
She shrugged. "It's all part of the acceptance."
"What are you talking about?"
"When criminals are sentenced to life in prison, there's a 94% chance of mental collapse within the first year." She shrugged. "Just leave them alone."
"No way, we have to stick together."
To my shock, with another awkward shrug, she began to walk away.
"Where are you going?" I shouted,
She didn't answer.
I need your help! Please! Don't you want to get out of here?
She held up a hand, a mild gesture of acknowledgement to a child having a tantrum, and kept walking. We were shipwreck survivors in a raging sea. Now they were forcing me to let go of their hands so they could sink into the waves and drown. I was going to be stuck here forever. Here, in the Neverworld, where I'd never grow old, never have a family, never fall in love. I was an immortal vampire without any perks. No bewitching beauty, no golden eyes or shimmering skin, no ability to run 300 miles an hour and flip cars over. I was a ghost with no haunt. I couldn't turn TVs to static or swivel porcelain doll heads 360 degrees, causing normal humans to have nervous breakdowns. I couldn't make toddlers stand in zombie trances in living rooms, captured in shaky found footage in the dead of night. I was a ticking clock in a timeless world. Without time, nothing had meaning. Never before had I understood how crucial the passage of time was to caring about something. It gave it an expiry date, a wick, a rush, a burn. Without it, everything sat in place, dumbly waiting. In my darkest moments, I thought of Jim. I'd come to Wincroft to find out what happened to him. Now, even that question, the one I'd spent the past year turning over and over in my mind, shriveled and flattened in the face of the Neverworld, like a little worm on the driveway in the beating sun. The night of the fight, I'd just returned from the dreamland. Letting myself into Wincroft, I heard screaming coming from upstairs. I sprinted up the staircase, realizing they'd locked themselves in ESS Burt's bathroom in the master suite. I knocked. Is everything okay? There was no answer but snickering. It's almost time for the vote. This was met with more laughter. Hello? The door was flung open. Whitley stood there wearing an oversized red sequined evening gown. Her eyes were bloodshot and smudged with eyeliner. Kipling was draped like an exhausted panther over the edge of the tub. Cannon was sitting on the counter, bandana tied marine style around his forehead. It was obvious from their flushed faces and the array of empty Dom Perignon bottles scattered across the tiles that they were wasted.
"Sister B, charmed to see you," Whitley said primly. "We won't be joining you. Ever."
"What?"
"We aren't voting. We're staying at Wincroft until the end of time, so there."
She rolled her eyes at the look on my face.
"Oh, God, Bea, stop mothering everyone. Your good girl nun act is never getting you chosen. In fact, it'll be over my maggot-infested body that I ever allow some Mother Teresa type to triumph on to life. No way. It goes against my very life philosophy that one must get filthy to live. You must get down in the dirt or you've done nothing." "I'm not Mother Teresa. I'm not a nun. I'm not even that good."
She waved her hand as if shooing a fly and turned, idly surveying her reflection in the mirror.
"It's not about the vote," I went on. "It's about staying together. We could lose ourselves forever in this place. Remember what Jim used to say about friendship? About us? What we have is a loyalty that can see us through anything."
Whitley bit her bottom lip, trying not to laugh.
"You still love him. Wow. He was the only person you ever saw in a room. And it's still true, even though he's dead. By the way, did you ever wonder why he chose you? Out of all the girls at school?"
She rubbed some lipstick off her chin. I braced myself because I knew what was coming. Her tantrums always began this way. She made some grand opening statement like a veteran prosecutor holding a jury rapt, the perfect set of words to slice her target in two.
He chose you because a plain setting makes the diamond sparkle brighter.